From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After decades of civil war and strife, months of planning, and an awkward day's delay, Afghanistan's Loya Jirga opened today in Kabul. More than 1,500 delegates selected from districts around the country have begun deliberation to choose the country's new government. This morning, just hours before the Grand Council convened, Afghanistan's former president bowed out of the race for head of state. Afghanistan's aging former king has already stepped aside. Now only interim leader Hamid Karzai remains as contender to lead the new Afghanistan. There's a lot riding on the Loya Jirga. Afghan and international hopes for stability and a better future, warlord and tribal interests and rivalries. Tonight, we will explore the inner workings of the conclave. The council opened today with a bang and controversy. Earlier today, Reuters reported that interim leader Hamid Karzai told a reporter he had been officially elected president at the day's meeting. Reuters later reported Karzai has now withdrawn his premature declaration of victory, claiming a misunderstanding at the meeting. I spoke with Christian Science Monitor reporter Philip Smucker earlier. He's in Kabul covering the Loya Jirga. I asked him to bring us up to date on the outcome of the first day.
It was a very confusing day. The Jirga started a day late, and then it started at 3 p.m. late in the afternoon. Began with an opening address from the former monarch, King Zahir Shah, who basically opened the floor and then quickly nominated the relatively young Hamid Karzai as the next leader of Afghanistan. Then Hamid Karzai spoke at length, praising everybody in the country. After that, an ethnic Tajik minister of interior got up and resigned, which was a bit of a surprise. At the end of the day, though, Hamid Karzai told the Reuters news agency that it was over, that he was now the president. And we had not seen any vote on the floor of the Loya Jirga, either in the form of clapping or hand-raising, as is traditional. So it was very confusing that he had declared himself the winner. It looks like he'll be the president, but he'll take some criticism for having declared himself the president before he was officially acknowledged by the entire body of the Loya Jirga.
We see that both the former king and the former president Rabbani stepped aside in favor of Hamid Karzai, but doesn't the Loya Jirga require a vote at some point? There are 1,550 Afghans under this great tent. Aren't they supposed to vote for the head of state?
The Loya Jirga has been traditionally something of a rubber stamp for the Pashtun kings. But we were under the impression that this one was quasi-democratic and it was going to have some kind of a voting system so that each individual who was up for an important office would be voted upon. According to what we've heard now from Hamid Karzai, it's more of an acknowledgement, like maybe he assumed that the clapping from his speech was acknowledgement that he was the president. Whereas he declared himself the winner to one news agency, a very respectable news agency, the other organizations are being a more skeptical, taking a little more hesitant line toward who is the next president for Afghanistan.
Reuters is quoting him very explicitly. He says, "It is finished. The assembly has voted for me." What kind of response from delegates did you get as they were coming out of today's Loya Jirga session?
We had people on the commission. The Loya Jirga Commission, these are kind of neutral Afghans who are helping organize it, and they said that even the procedures for electing the president had not been decided upon. It almost strikes of, a deal in advance. There was one other indication of possibly having been chosen by somebody as the leader, because the Farsi television here in Kabul mentioned the same thing, and that is run by the people around him, mostly Tajiks in the Panjshiri crowd who are in power now. And it may have been the quid pro quo that the king kind of stepped aside, not challenge Karzai, and then the Tajiks would have their minister of interior step down as he did, and there would be some kind of a deal cut to create a multi-ethnic ministership. Within the most important ministerships, there would be some division between the all-important ethnicities of Tajik and Pashtun. But I believe that most of the delegates are not under the impression that they voted today. So it will probably come up again tomorrow. And I understand from Ahmed Rashid, who is the author of the book, The Taliban, that Mr. Karzai is going to come under a lot of fire tomorrow.
Philip, what business remains on the agenda of the Loya Jirga beyond choosing a head of state?
It's basically divvying up the important positions in the ministerships. This is a country that's running along relatively well, considering they just finished a war 6 months ago. And Karzai, he's done a good job. He gave a great speech today, by the way, that was very acknowledging of every ethnic group, what their contributions had been, who were the martyrs, martyrs on all sides, people who had fought the Taliban. So just a matter, really, of deciding upon these key positions like defense, the Minister of Defense, who's going to create the new army. Beyond that, there's the Ministry of Interior, which has the secret police. Everybody wants it to be egalitarian and, not overbearing. And it'll be a difficult task. A lot of the delegates want to vote individually for those posts, and they want to have a say. But as of what happened today, it looks like a lot of the Loya Jirga will be kind of a rubber stamp for what is decided upon, maybe even by the Western powers and the current interim regime. We didn't see any democracy in action today. If the coming days are anything like today, and then people are declaring themselves the victor, we have a system that is less than quasi-democratic.
Philip Smucker is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with us earlier from Kabul. Among the thousands of delegates gathered for the Loya Jirga in Kabul is Kayyum Karzai, older brother of interim leader Hamid Karzai. Kayyum was running his Baltimore restaurant last fall. He returned to Kandahar in December to help with the rebuilding of his homeland. Now he's an officially elected delegate to the Loya Jirga, representing his province in southern Afghanistan. I spoke with him a few hours ago before Hamid Karzai withdrew his hasty declaration and asked if his brother Hamid was officially the president.
No, I don't think the chairman has said that he has been elected or this is final. In fact, he said that he became a candidate and was proposed a candidate by His Majesty the former king, and the formal election is going to be held tomorrow, and this is where we are now.
All right, so we'll say that there's some confusion in interpretation of today's events. Today's meeting was for a couple of hours. Your brother spoke, the king spoke. What's your sense of the beginning of the Loya Jirga? Is it off to a good start? Are delegates feeling good, in your view, about the way the proceedings are going ahead?
I believe that it was a very orderly Loya Jirga session, and I suspect that after today, tomorrow, we will hear from the delegates, including myself, as to which way the delegates are going to lean and what views are about the issues and the situation in Afghanistan.
Kayyum Karzai, you know the United States well. You've lived for a long time in Baltimore. As Americans observe these proceedings and read the reports out of Kabul, how should Americans interpret what we hear? Is this a democratic procedure along the same lines that we might expect at a political convention in the United States, a presidential nomination convention, or proceedings in the U.S. Congress, or is there a different flavor we should be alert to?
I think the Loya Jirga, it is democratic in the Afghan political culture context, and it should not be compared to either the session of Congress or the session of Parliament, or for that matter, to the party conventions in the United States, simply because the Loya Jirga institutions are convened when the proper institutions or the lack of institutions is not able to solve a particular problem that the nation is facing. So it becomes almost a spontaneous gathering of the elders for which we do not have a set procedures.
And what is your sense, and again, acknowledging that you're the elder brother of the interim president, but what is your sense of what Afghanistan needs from this Loya Jirga?
Well, it has to come with a consensus of electing the head of state. That's number one. And two, the Bonn Agreement assumes that there should be the decision made by the Loya Jirga concerning key ministries in the cabinet or key leadership roles in the government. And two, the Loya Jirga will properly prioritize the issues that the government must attend to, and I suspect and the order of these issues will be security for the Afghan people and the cleaning up of the government and then the reconstruction process.
There are some complaints in the early reporting coming out of Kabul from delegates that foreign powers are playing too large a role behind the scenes in determining the outcome of the Loya Jirga. What's your sense of that?
I don't believe that that is the case. Obviously, that there are some losers in the process, that they are resorting to these propaganda. I believe that there is behind-the-scenes consensus building or politicking. That's a part of the process, and that's a part of the political process in every country.
I wonder about your personal view as a member of the Karzai family. Your family's been involved in Afghan politics for a long time. At one level, it must seem an accomplishment simply to be holding a Loya Jirga not long after Afghanistan went through the Taliban years and a war. What are your personal feelings this week as you look out on this extraordinary gathering?
I am absolutely delighted because my father and Hamid Karzai, my brother, and I, for the last 23 years, have consistently, sometimes in a overwhelming situation where we could not make any headways about the Loya Jirga, finally were able to slowly bring Loya Jirga to the forefront of the Afghan politics and convince the international community that this is the only forum in which the Afghans can freely decide the destiny of their country. So I'm delighted that this is happening.
And when and if your brother Hamid Karzai is officially proclaimed the new president out of this meeting, will there be a celebration at your restaurant in Baltimore?
I don't think that we'll move that far for celebration. I believe there will be celebration in Kabul, definitely.
But and on the home front, do you think the waiters will be putting up a cheer on the U.S. side?
Yeah, I think that they should be delighted there, and if they would like to make an occasion of it, that would be certainly welcomed by me.
Kayhem Karzai, thanks so much for joining us. I hope we can talk again after the Loya Jirga wraps up and get your view of how things are going ahead.
Certainly, Tom. You're quite welcome.
Kayhem Karzai is brother of Afghanistan's interim leader, Hamid Karzai, and an official delegate to the Loya Jirga. I spoke to him from Kabul. Listeners, did you ever imagine you would know so much about Afghanistan? Post 9/11, can you see how not just Afghanistan's, but America's fate is linked to the Loya Jirga? And is the U.S. playing the role it should as Afghanistan struggles to rebuild? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll have more guests from Kabul and beyond. But first, with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack. And what do you make of this wild day of reports from the Loya Jirga in Kabul?
Well, it wouldn't have surprised Mark Twain. I mean, democracy is a messy business. What does surprise me is the sort of U.S. thumb so visible in this matter, in sort of in, you know, getting the king out and getting our man in. I know Zalmay Khalilzad. I worked with him in the 80s, got stuff from him about writing about the Soviet war there. He's a very able and bright man.
This is but the this U.S. looks, representative in Kabul.
Yeah, this looks like a real diplomatic blunder. Of all people in the world, these people are touchy about foreign intervention, about foreigners, you know, superintending their destiny. And here our diplomat there does something like this, so obvious as this, it's not a good, it wasn't a good day for American diplomatic manners.
We'll hear more about that, but I was surprised to think that the United States even needed to intervene in that way at this point.
Yes. I mean, I guess they just didn't want some sort of ethnic split, you know, among the delegates with Pashtuns voting for the former king and others voting for the incumbent, Mr. Karzai.
So, and they're determined not to get it. Listeners, we are talking tonight about the Loya Jirga and the fate of Afghanistan. You are welcome to join the conversation. Is Afghanistan climbing on to the road to stability? And what obligation does the United States have to support, to underwrite Afghan nation building? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Loya Jirga. What a name. And now it's on the lips even of Americans. Who would have thought it only a year ago? About the Loya Jirga and the fate of Afghanistan. What do you think? Is Afghanistan climbing onto the road to stability? Does the United States risk denying credibility to the new Afghan government if it gets too involved? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by our news analyst, Jack Beatty, and now from Kabul, Afghanistan, Sarah Chase. Sarah has reported from NPR, for NPR, from the Balkans, France, and Afghanistan. She's currently working for a Kandahar-based public policy NGO. Good evening, very late there, and welcome, Sarah Chase.
Early, the cocks are crowing, as it were. The roosters are getting at it. How are you?
We're very well here. I also want to welcome into our conversation tonight, joining us from San Jose, California, William Beeman. He's professor of anthropology and Middle East studies at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. Good evening and welcome, William Beeman.
Hi, very nice to be back with you again.
Sarah Chase, give us the scene in Afghanistan. I don't know how much of today's Loya Jirga you caught. But give us a sense, as you see it, I think you drove up across country from Kandahar today, of the mood in Kabul, the flap today over Hamid Karzai's declaration and then retraction, and what kind of start are we off to here?
The scene is one of, you know, enormous anticipation. Across the country, people are listening to the radios. They're gathered around the radios. It's almost the way it was during the U.S.-led air war, where, you know, families or groups of friends would sit around the radio listening to proceedings. These are being broadcast live, and so Afghans are able to follow what's going on. Approaching Kabul, there are a number of roadblocks. Security is very tight. You go through maybe three or four roadblocks on the main road into Kabul, and it's, you know, people are screened very carefully as to whether and why they have reason to be in Kabul. As for the flap, I haven't heard any fallout from it here, and I suspect a couple of things are going on. One is that it's a bigger flap amongst the delegates, or in particular amongst people who have access to the newswire, which reported the statement by Chairman Karzai. The other thing that I can, again, it's speculation, but what I can imagine having happened, is, you know, what Karzai's older brother Kayum was saying just a few minutes ago on the air is that this is a consensus-building process. The effort, the politicking, discussing, negotiating, which has been leading up to this event, has been very specific and very intense, and that's not necessarily not a democratic process. And that kind of discussion that's been going on has, particularly once the king gets up in front of the audience and says, I am not standing in, I'm not running for the interim presidency, there's no one else. It is clear that Mr. Karzai will then be elected. What I can imagine him saying, having said, is that's it. It's clinched now. You know, I've been elected, not literally meaning that there's been a roll call vote. And so in that sense, I don't think it would come as any surprise to anyone in Afghanistan that he's been elected. And I don't think ordinary people would necessarily take it amiss that he says that, given the way the events have unrolled.
If I may, for full disclosure, we talked earlier with Kayum, and I guess if you could tell us, you work with Kayum in some capacity in your NGO. Tell us about that relationship, and also, if you would, what you have seen in the Kandahar area and perhaps elsewhere of preparations for the Loya Jirga. How was the ground set for this meeting?
Sure. Absolutely. Kayum actually founded this NGO originally in 1998, and a lot of the movement, the effort to bring about a consensus that Loya Jirga was an institution that could have a positive impact on solving Afghanistan's problems, was gestated in this NGO. I mean, the effort to bring Afghans in the diaspora and inside Afghanistan around to the idea that a way to settle the problem in this country without bloodshed would be through this kind of a forum. The other point that I would like to make just in reference to what Jack said is that I don't think it's correct to see an ethnic split with Pashtuns favoring the king over Karzai and other ethnic groups favoring Karzai over the king. On the contrary, as I've seen in the south, in Kandahar, the Pashtuns in the south, you know, I mean, the degree of faith in Hamid Karzai and the degree of support for him is very difficult to even describe. You know, if anything, there's a kind of emotional attachment to the king and a sense that, you know, he's a kind of talisman who could bring the country together. And in that sense, his lack of clarity as to whether he really wanted a substantive role in the government or not added a kind of static to the whole pre-Loya Jirga, as I say, discussions, negotiations, consensus-building process. And that's why his declaration was so important.
Bill Beaman, we're going to go back to Sarah to ask her more about the preparations for this Loya Jirga, but if you would be good enough to give us some of the history here, the background. Where did this institution come from? Does it literally mean Grand Council? How long is its lineage, and how important has it been historically to Afghanistan?
The term Jirga is a Pashtun term, and it is really a term that's derived from the notion of a tribal council. And virtually all people who are involved in tribal organization have some kind of organization like this in order for decision making to take place. And the term Loya Jirga was coined in 1924 when the modern Afghan state was formed as a way of trying to get all of the ethnic groups that make up modern Afghanistan on board in common support of the monarchy.
But we read that there's a thousand-year tradition one way and another of this kind of jirga.
Well, you know, people say this, and I whether it's a thousand years exactly or not,
right.
There's no question that, again, tribal peoples have had these councils for a very long time. There's no question about that.
Is there a formal procedure for electing or selecting the delegates who attend?
In a normal tribal organization, what you really have are what we would call sections of the tribe, and there are elders in each section, and the elders are the ones who congregate in these particular situations. And actually, it seems that in this case, the Loya Jirga has involved selection by local councils or local groups, and for the most part, elders have been selected. But there have been some seats that have been specifically reserved for ethnic minorities and also for women. And so that's one way in which the construction of this Loya Jirga is really different than anything that had taken place in the past.
And as you've listened to the enormous expectations of what this Loya Jirga might or could accomplish for Afghanistan over these recent months, Bill Beaman, have they seemed outsized to you? Have the expectations grown too large? Or could we, out of this, reach a consensus and firm footing to go forward, which would be a big deal?
There is no question in my mind that this must take place in order for there to be a symbolic ratification of whatever government is going to take place in Afghanistan. One of the differences that has led to the present troubles in Afghanistan over the last several decades has been that communist rule was more or less imposed on the country without the assent of the people, and the taint of that particular era must be wiped away symbolically by the congregation of a Loya Jirga.
Sarah Chase, give us as much sense as you can of the physical setting. We've seen the photographs of some men in Western style suits, others in turbans and traditional Afghan dress. Is this considered a place to show your Afghan roots or to reach for Western style democracy? What's the flavor around the Loya Jirga?
You know, even in clothing, it's not showing off in some sense to wear Afghan style clothes. That's mm-hmm. what everyone outside of Kabul wears. In fact, to wear Western clothes, basically you're only teachers, school teachers, and it's seen as a kind of school uniform, and teachers go to school wearing their traditional dress, and they change in their teacher's office. But I think this is seen as a deeply indigenous institution. And so, again, our notion of, you know, Afghanness as somehow being undemocratic and the West as being democratic, that doesn't compute here. I mean, I think they see this as, Afghans see this as an indigenous collective decision-making process. And so you go wearing clothes that you feel comfortable in. And there has been, you know, there's a lot of discussion. There's a lot of, you know, it is a collective decision-making process. I really can't come up with a better way of describing it. And that is slightly different than our notion of, you know, hide in a voting, you know, be isolated in a voting booth kind of democracy. On the other hand, think of, pardon?
One of our commentators likened it to the Iowa caucuses. And I think there is something to that.
Yeah. A little wild and woolly.
Absolutely. Or think of Congress. I mean, there isn't a vote in Congress that hasn't been preceded by a lot of, you know, consensus building, persuasion, trying to get people from the other party on board, you know, all these kinds of things. And it's, I think in that sense, it is similar to Western gatherings.
And yet, Jack Beatty, I was struck today, Jack Beatty, by the way in which in our globalized world, even an old Afghan traditional style of meeting is subjected to the expectations and interpretation of world media. And interpretations began to be laid down very quickly today. The words were acrimony, chaos, confusion, overreaching, and foreign involvement. This is the kind of envelope around reporting on today's meeting.
Yeah, as if it were a summit meeting in Europe or something like that. We immediately apply our yardstick to all these phenomena. I have a question, though, about the ethnic composition of this Karzai government. Isn't that one of the big issues here? The Pashtuns have felt left out of this government, as I understand it, and that because it reflects the facts on the ground after the Northern Alliance won, and it was essentially a Tajik government, a Tajik-dominated government, and the Pashtuns need some sense of getting back into the government. Is that going to happen here, and does that mean the Tajiks are going to have to surrender power?
That's one of the really interesting questions. Karzai is, of course, ethnic Pashtun, but he doesn't enjoy really the support of the ethnic Pashtuns in his own country.
I'm sorry. Can I interject?
Please do, Sarah.
Absolutely not true. That's absolutely not true. He is absolutely adulated by the Pashtuns in the south of Afghanistan. Go ahead.
Bill Beaman, what do you make of that? How does that conflict with your...
Actually, I'm very interested to hear that. Because the situation that I think one of the reasons that he enjoyed the support of the United States was that he was a Pashtun who enjoyed the support of the Tajik population, and so therefore he turns out to be a consensus leader.
Sarah Chase, I'm sorry, dealing with the cell phone is a little tricky, but we're glad to have you. Let me ask you two things there, just to get into that and go beyond it. First of all, if you could describe how the ethnic relationships are playing out around this Loya Jirga. And I guess, secondly, the big question hanging over this is the warlords. They've taken de facto control of many parts of the country. And how is their fate and future being decided here, or is it?
I think those are the two key questions. In terms of ethnic relations, yes, I would say there is a degree of ethnic tension in Afghanistan. Yes, it's true that the Pashtuns feel that the distribution not only of ministry posts but of subordinate positions by the Tajik ministers, who appointed, for example, almost all Tajik generals in the army and almost all Tajik diplomats, that has created a certain degree of rancor in the south. It is true that Karzai is seen as someone who can build bridges, but I wouldn't go so far as to say that he's someone who's supported by Tajiks and not by Pashtuns. On the contrary, the point is that he is a bridge builder. His base of support is in the south with the Pashtuns. I ran some focus groups, actually, and literally could not get any of the participants to say anything negative about him. I mean, the degree of respect for him in the South is enormous. They Pashtuns, I would say, assume, they are expecting that the Loya Jirga will result in a government that is more ethnically balanced. But I would say that your second question is even more important, because they don't talk, or at least many people don't talk in ethnic terms, but rather in terms of the warlords. And they say, so it's not so much, oh, there are too many Tajiks in the government, but there are too many loyalists of the Northern Alliance. And so, in fact, they see that the government is made up of what they consider to be former military commanders who were part of the Mujahideen factions that destroyed Afghanistan prior to the rise of the Taliban. And so what is of most concern to Afghans is that these warlords, among whom they, at least the Pashtuns, count Northern Alliance leaders, that these former military commanders be slowly but very firmly moved out of power, and that what people say the previous governor, the previous people, the previous rulers, not be allowed to take such a large role in the future government. And that, I think, is going to be the key issue of this Loya Jirga. Does it take on this problem of the warlords? And
Sarah Chase, please stand by. I want to get one call in here before the break. Marcia's on the line. Welcome, Marcia. You're on the air.
Well, thank you for taking my
call. Sure.
Quite a long time. I just want, just as a side question, you have to really be skeptical of someone who's speaking for an NGO. I just want to put that out there, and I appreciate you saying, can we have full disclosure around that?
We're for full disclosure.
One of the things that I want to raise is what Ralph Nayer raises. What's our exit strategy out of this godforsaken land? I am totally against, and I, you know, Jack Beatty, I think, really hit on it today. It's so clear that our role in this is about manipulating these people that no good can come of this. This reminds me, I did a lot of study on Iran and what happened with the Shah, and in the same way, we're in, again, manipulating the politics of another country, and it always comes back to bite us, always.
Marcia, let's take that question right away. Our time is short before the break. I'm going to put it to Bill Beeman first. Let me speak just briefly to this Sarah Chase issue. She is with an NGO now, but we acknowledge her long and highly respected service to NPR for a long time before that. But Bill Beeman, to this question of the U.S. hand in Afghanistan now, Marcia says it always comes back to bite us. She wants to know our exit strategy. Are those the right questions now?
Well, that's an excellent question, and one of the things that has to be figuring in this situation is that the government or the leaders of Afghanistan or that are trying to put together this government know that unless they please the international community, and especially the United States, they're not going to get the money they need to rebuild their country. And I think that's been put to them very, very clearly. The United States has a tendency to want to install plumbers everywhere and around the world. That is not necessarily bad people, but people who are reliable and who will do things that are predictable from our standpoint. And Hamid Karzai is a prime candidate. He may be an excellent leader, and I don't want to cast any aspersions on him. But he is certainly our choice, and that is something that may come back to haunt him.
We'll come back and talk about that. What obligation does the United States have to support, to underwrite Afghan nation building? We're talking about the Loya Jirga. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Loya Jirga going on now in Kabul, the Loya Jirga and the fate of Afghanistan. Our guests tonight are Bill Beeman. He's professor of anthropology and Middle East studies at Brown University. And Sarah Chase, longtime NPR reporter, now working with an NGO in Kandahar, Afghanistan, and bringing us by satellite phone tonight the most extraordinary display of Afghan rooster crowing that we've probably ever had on public radio in America. It's just fantastic. Listeners, here are the questions. First of all, what obligation does the United States have to support to underwrite Afghan nation building? Does the U.S. risk denying credibility to the Afghan government if it's too involved? And I guess, can Americans with our own smoke-filled political backrooms throw stones at the Loya Jirga? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Steve is on the line. Welcome, Steve. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. I want to echo the last caller and really bemoan U.S. involvement in the process. I think we made a big mistake in the 50s with John Foster Dulles and his foreign policy. I mean, the other caller mentioned Iran, but that was just one example where pragmatists, so-called pragmatists, held sway at the State Department. And
how do you send your bombers and troops into a country and then not be somewhat involved in its big building rebuilding?
We should be involved, but instead of the so-called pragmatic view of just seeing things just in power relationships and who would be best for us and who would not be best for us, I think we should support our own ideals, our own Declaration of Independence. And I think if we had done that, this which is maybe looked upon as an idealistic viewpoint as opposed to the pragmatic viewpoint, I think we'd be a lot better off today. We wouldn't have the problems with Saudi Arabia that in part led to Al-Qaeda. And
So you're really saying let democracy take its own course in Afghanistan. I want to put that to both Sarah and William Beaman. Sarah, you first. What degree of U.S. involvement do you see here? Is democracy taking its own course in Afghanistan? Are we getting off to a good start?
Well, I would actually put the pragmatist versus the idealist argument in a different way, which is to look at the support that the United States has given to warlords. That's where I see the pragmatist acting, where we are in fact paying commanders who are shelling Afghan towns in order to seize power from governors who have been legitimately appointed by the central government. That's where I see the U.S. pragmatic hand acting. These armed men are supposedly useful for us in hunting down Al-Qaeda members, which in itself is questionable. And so there's been a lot of U.S. Financial and moral support to really the very worst elements in Afghan society, the very elements that brought about the situation of chaos and anarchy, which led to the rise of the Taliban. Then, at that period back in the 80s and 90s, we were also financially supporting the most extremist religious extremist factions around. Whereas I think an appropriate role for U.S. involvement is to at least provide, not political support, maybe not quote-unquote open, backing, but provide support to those forces in this country that are democratic, that are bridge builders, that are seeking a positive, constructive, positive and constructive role for Afghanistan and an involvement in the international community in a responsible way. So I think the best role for U.S. policy is to make distinctions between these two forces.
William Beaman, let me put the same thing to you, and I guess particularly with Sarah Che's emphasis on the warlord issue, it did emerge in wire stories coming out of Kabul today, this sense that perhaps behind the scenes, or not so far behind, the United States is actually trying to cement some warlord positions through the Loya Jirga because they have become, in effect, our allies, our guardians on the ground.
It's a very curious business. Some of our reports today said that at the time that Zahir Shah was renouncing his own claim to leadership, there were military commanders outside the tents or downstairs that were claiming that they would start a civil war unless he were elevated to a leadership position. So we seem to be operating two sides against the middle ourselves in supporting different groups for different purposes. There's no question that our principal mission in Afghanistan is actually not to establish democratic institutions. That may be something that we're trying to affect in order to get stability into the country, but we still have not completed our military mission, and there's no question that unless there's a stable government in Kabul, the military mission will not be completed. So that's where our primary loyalty is going to be, and I'm sorry to hear that, because I agree with Sarah Chase that the support of these military commanders, and I actually don't like the term warlord very much, but the military commanders that have troops on the ground that are helping us are not very nice people in general, and they're people who are going to cause trouble in the future.
Jack Beatty, we've heard the name John Foster Dulles raised here. Do you feel that old Cold War ambiguity around American interests at work, even as Afghanistan tries to rebuild and establish some kind of democratic footing?
Well, I think, I mean, just from reading about it, I get the feeling that we're focusing much too narrowly just on this military question. I mean, it's important and it's salient. But in the long run, our best guarantee that al-Qaeda will not revive in Afghanistan is a stable, functioning Afghanistan, not one pulled apart by warlords, not one to which we deny aid to the military. We say, build your own army, but we're not going to give them money from that, apparently. So I think we're sort of defining the problem de minimis, and it needs to be seen, as Sarah said, as, you know, these are the forces that led to the Taliban, that led to a failed state, that led to al-Qaeda having a root there.
I couldn't agree more with both Sarah and Jack on this point, that the United States really does need to get take responsibility for the fact that we have been really over the last few decades partly responsible for the destruction of Afghanistan, and we, I think, are definitely responsible for its rebuilding, not only out of humanitarian grounds, but out of a national self-interest. A stable Afghanistan is what we want. But we have not given over the development money that we've promised, nor the money for the rebuilding of security forces. We really haven't followed through on the promises that we made at the time that we got rid of the Taliban.
And so there we are, trying to find our way through all that. Fadiki's on the line. Welcome, Fadiki.
Yes, good evening.
Hi.
Let me just begin and say I find some of the terminology, some of the musing that's being used, like exit strategy, pragmatism, democracy.
It's the American toolkit of vocabulary, Fadiki.
Yes, I understand. But, I mean, the reality is that in July 2001, the U.S. government was negotiating with the Taliban to build a pipeline from the former Soviet republics through Afghanistan to Pakistan to the Black Sea, whatever. And the Taliban said no, and the United States said, well, we're going to build this with or without you. Then it was September 2001. And so the reality here is that there is a self-interest thing here for the United States. It's about the vast reserves of oil that are over there in terms of this pipeline. So Karzai is their boy, and they don't want to have that whole piece disrupted by his not being in place. So it's about the oil. It's not about democracy or exit strategy or the al-Qaeda. This is about the military-industrial complex, oil, and profit. First.
Okay, Fadiki, we thank you for your call. Sarah Chase, I want you to step way back off that tee here and answer it, but also just to give us your larger sense. I mean, here's this kind of language, and it comes back from Cold War days. Karzai's their boy. The U.S. is just there for oil interests. Do you buy either of those characterizations? And step back further. How do you see interests unfolding here, Afghan and American?
I think human affairs are more complicated than they are often distilled out to be. I don't want to talk about conspiracy theories or anything. It is clear that the oil interest is a large interest in Afghanistan. It certainly was a guiding element in U.S. policy during the Taliban years. But it's not the only interest that is operating. And that's why, going back to what we were saying about pragmatists back off the vocabulary, but about backing for warlords and backing for democratic forces, it does seem as though the United States has two separate and conflicting policies in Afghanistan. And in that sense, the oil interest is a third interest, obviously driving the equation, but it's not, I don't think it's fair to say it's the only thing that this is about. And that's part of what makes things so confusing and contradictory. Is a particular element of the U.S. government, like the Pentagon, may be pursuing one specific strategy and using its own tactics, which may in fact go counter to a separate goal and a separate interest of the U.S. government, which may be pursued with totally other tactics. I think it's unfair to discount the notion of democracy building in this country. It's unfair to assume that someone like Hamid Karzai is only around because he's going to, you know, acquiesce to whatever U.S. oil deal is eventually struck. Obviously, he's going to be involved in oil negotiations. Obviously, there is a pipeline, potential pipeline in the works. But I don't think he's anyone's stooge. And I don't think, you know, I mean, just from everything I know about him, I think he genuinely does have an interest in the future of his country, and he's not the only one who does. Is that stepping far enough back? Is that...
Yeah, I think
what
that's absolutely. Bill Beaman, come in here with us.
Yeah, I do want to point out that a new plan for a pipeline has just been announced in the last about 10 days. That's a pipeline from Turkmenistan through Afghanistan and through Pakistan, and that gets pretty much all of the players on board that are currently interested in the situation. And that's a new pipeline route. So we have yet another thing to talk about when we're talking about oil.
So the oil will flow. Bill Beaman, our time grows short. Step back with us for just a few seconds. How will you gauge whether this, at the end of the week, whether this has been a successful Loya Jirga?
You know, I think we need to point out that this is going to be a stepwise process. That is, the government of Afghanistan is not being established with the Loya Jirga. It's a provisional government. The next stage will be the establishment of a constitution and finally full-fledged elections that will lead to a permanent government. So it is important for us to understand that the whole ballgame isn't over with this Loya Jirga. It is going in a stepwise process. The problem for Hamid Karzai, and I really will tell you this, is that that he has a very, very delicate road to tread. I think that if he gets associated too closely with the West or with any party in Afghanistan, he's in some danger.
Bill Beaman, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
You're most welcome.
William Beaman is professor of anthropology and Middle East studies at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. Sarah Chase, you're such a trooper to be up at the crack of dawn talking to us from Kabul. Thank you very much. We look forward to talking with you again.
My pleasure, and I do hope so.
Thanks, Sarah. Good night. Jack Beatty, step back with us. Oh, I should say, Sarah Chase is working with a public policy nonprofit NGO in Kandahar, Afghanistan. She was a longtime reporter for National Public Radio. Jack Beatty, step back share a bit of what you hear in this conversation.
Well, President Kennedy was fond of saying that a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step, and this is a step, but there's such a long way to go. And when one reads details like, you know, fathers having to sell their daughters in order to survive, and on the one hand, and on the other hand, of flourishing the return of the poppy trade. And, I mean, just the problems of this country where everything has been, where foreign powers have intervened for 23 years and smashed it beyond repair, you know, almost beyond repair. It's got to be encouraging to these people to have this single step and a big one taken. Just having the forum.
It is an accomplishment. We look forward to seeing how it works out. Jack Beatty, thank you for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Amada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Darren Manoogian and Laura Tanguso. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded.